Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. He's an award-winning author of 32 books and a two-time Fulbright Scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia. His books include Queenpins, Notorious Women Gangsters of the Modern Era, and Sergeant Smack, The Legendary Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers. He's also the producer of three award-winning documentaries, including the soon-to-be-released The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You could go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Get out there and buy his books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Also, be sure to visit his website at Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. Here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he'll be publishing an anthology about influential people from Thunder Bay area, and early next year, a book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like ice-cold beer on a hot day in Coney Island. Thank you very much. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Frank Culotta. Culotta teamed up with mystery and nonfiction writer Dennis Griffin to write Culotta, the life of a Chicago criminal, Las Vegas mobster, and government witness. Frank Culotta appeared in Martin Scorsese's 1995 blockbuster movie Casino, recreating an actual murder he committed in 1979. From burglary to armed robbery and murder, infamous bad guy Frank Culotta tells it all. Culotta started out as a thug on the mean streets of Chicago, becoming a trusted lieutenant for the notorious and deadly mobster Tony Spilotro in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank our thousands of listeners from around the world for tuning into Crime Beat. There's no turning back the clock now, Ronnie. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week, and it's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank our production people at Artists First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony for making it possible. Like I said many times before, Internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, now here's this week's mailbag. This one is from Sanjeev of Mumbai, India, who writes, "Listen to your last show a couple of weeks ago with Evan Wright, author of American Desperado. Great interview. I happened to be in the United States about a month ago and picked up the book. Read it on the long flight from New York to Mumbai, where I live. Loved the book. Great show, gentlemen. My friends and I are regular listeners." Hey, Ronnie, all the way from India. Nice letter.
Yeah, hey, man. I tell you, you have a great story. People anywhere in the world will enjoy it. And here we have a guy in India reading a book about a major drug trafficker that operated largely in Latin America, and he enjoyed the story.
Amazing, amazing. Right. Thanks very much, Sanjeev. Now, this one is from Francis of Colorado, who writes, Your program with Kathy Lynn Austin was an eye-opener. The illegal trafficking of weapons is a pervasive, ugly part of our civilization today, and I use the term loosely. Bloodsuckers like Victor Boot should be strung up and left on a lamppost for a week for all to see. Prison is too good for him. Austin should be given the Congressional Medal of Honor for her work in tracking down these merchants of death. Hey, Ronnie, Francis doesn't mince any words on this subject. Any
right, I wish he had some strong feelings about the subject, right? But, you know, Kathy Austin did a great job explaining arms trafficking. You know, we know a lot about drug trafficking, but not as much about arms trafficking. And, you know, it's the biggest illegal activity in the world, and I'm waiting for her movie to come out, you know, with Angelina Jolie. He's going to play her like we were talking about, and hopefully it'll come out pretty soon. I think that's going to be a great movie.
Absolutely. She's a gorgeous lady, always entertaining. I'm looking forward to that one for sure.
Right.
Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, and tell our listeners what you'll be doing in the coming weeks.
Right. Right now, we're finally getting out the documentary a lot of people have been waiting for, Frank Matthews, the story, Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. And it's going to be a great documentary. We're going to be at the Museum of the American Gangster in New York, April 11th, for the New York premiere. And we're going to premiere it at Durham, Frank Matthews' hometown. As you know, Matthews disappeared in 1973 with $15 to $20 million and a beautiful woman has never been seen again. And so it's a great story, and we're hoping to publicize it in the coming weeks. And it's going to be available by instant digital download from our website at frankmatthewsstory.com. So that'll be available in about 10 days. For next week, we have Stacy Dietrich in a command performance, talking about her career as a police detective specializing in sex crime cases. And since she retired from the police work, she's become a noted author and best-selling author. So it'll be a very interesting session with her next week. Willie?
Absolutely, and good luck with the documentary on April 11th, Ronnie. I'm sure everything will go well. Way to go on that. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here is rap sheet item number one. Dateline, New York City, February 29th, 2012. Ex-gangster's wife gets 5 years. Ronnie, the ex-wife of notorious drug lord Frank Lucas says she still has soft feelings for the one-time heroin kingpin dubbed the American Gangster. Juliana Ferret Rodriguez yesterday begged the judge for mercy and compassion so she could take care of her ailing ex-hubby, but she got slapped with a mandatory 5-year prison sentence for scheming to sell cocaine to a government informant. Hey, Ronnie, when you do the crime, you have to pay the time, man.
Well, I'll tell you, she's 65 years old, and she's lucky she only got 5 years. She was selling 2 kilos of cocaine in Puerto Rico, and she was set up in a sting. And she did the same thing back in the mid-80s and got caught and went to prison. I know that because I interviewed Frank Lucas twice, and, of course, I wrote a book about him, did a documentary on him. And as far as wanting to apologize to her husband, Frank, she calls him her husband. I don't know if they're married. Frank Lucas. Frank's going to have to apologize to her because has been arrested for check fraud and is waiting trial on that case. So they may have to write each other in prison. He's 81 years old. It's really a sad story considering American Gangster is one of the biggest movies, you know, the last 10 years in terms of box office sales.
Yeah, you bet. Well, he's 81 years old. If he gets sentenced to any time,
right,
he might not see the light of day.
Well, he's in poor health. He's in a wheelchair. And
yeah.
So anyways, it's, you know, people, you know, make your own bed, right?
You bet. Yeah, you got that right. Now, let's get on a rap sheet. Item number two, Dateline, Saturday, February 25th, 2012, Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Carnival cruise passengers robbed at gunpoint on ship's sponsored tour in Mexico. Hey, Ron, 22 passengers on Carnival Splendor, the ship called the Carnival Splendor, were robbed at gunpoint Thursday while on a ship-sponsored tour of Puerto Vallarta in Mexico. At least one Mexican media outlet said the passengers were returning by bus to their ship at approximately 5 p.m. after spending time in El Nogalito, a tourist area known for its lush natural setting. Masked assailants stopped the bus and robbed the cruisers of their money, watches, and cameras. Hey, Ronnie, it looks like even the tourist areas of Mexico are no safer than the border towns. What's your take on this?
Really? I mean, give me three reports of this, three incidents like this, and I'll say there's a pattern. This is really really a non-story. I mean, tourists get robbed every day somewhere in the United States, and the only reason it became a story is the fact that, there's a drug war going on in Mexico, and, nobody got hurt. And we had our guest, Sylvia Longmire, Mexican border expert on. She said Mexico was safe. I agree with her, especially now, right? I mean, because the Carnival cruise lines are going to do everything possible to keep their passengers safe, but it's really a non-story.
Absolutely. Well, it's going to be, like you said, it'll be safer because, all the law enforcement people will be keeping an eye on everybody, and there's no fear for anybody
down. I was in Northern Ireland. I was in Northern Ireland for several years. I used to go back there. And people say, why are you going there? It's so dangerous. I always pointed out that no American was ever killed during the Troubles.
Anyway, it's one of those stories that we thought we'd bring you and just let everybody know who are planning to make a trip to Mexico, not to be too concerned about
it. You're the bearer of non-news today.
Well, anyway, Ronnie, we have to bring that story. Now, just before we get on to our very featured guest, Frank Coletta, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and Bill Rib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on the Internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Frank Coletta. Along with author Dennis Griffin, Coletta co-authored the best-selling book titled Coletta, The Life of a Chicago Criminal, Las Vegas Mobster, and Government Witness. Frank Coletta was sent to Las Vegas by the Chicago mob to watch the back of Tony Spilotro and to provide muscle when necessary. Coletta's world was a high profile of heists, street muscle, and murder for hire. Things started to fall apart for the crew in the early 1980s. Spilotro, trying to cover up his back, told the Chicago outfit it was all Coletta's fault. Finding out that the outfit approved a contract to have Coletta whacked, he turned government witness. In this one-of-a-kind broadcast, Frank Coletta will describe and discuss his extraordinary life as a mobster in this one-of-a-kind broadcast. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to Crime Beat, Frank Coletta.
Yeah, I'm here.
Your book is a fascinating read, and you lit a remarkable life. I was just wondering, and you tell a lot. I mean, it's really amazing. Did you leave anything out in the book that might have been too sensitive or might have got you in legal trouble, or is this the whole story?
Well, no, there's a lot more. They edit a lot, and there's only so much you can put in the book. And, it's all about crimes, robberies and stuff, that they left out.
Right, on that. But it's a, it's a quick read. It's a good read, and congratulations on the book. You grew up tough right from the beginning, right? You were born to the tough life, to the criminal life. Is that an accurate way to describe your early beginnings?
Yeah, I was a product of my environment, where I grew up at. That's the kind of people that were in that area. So that's what I became, one of them, because I looked up to these people. And it was an interesting life while it lasted.
Right. Well, your co-author, Dennis Griffin, writes that you had a violent temper. That must have got you into a lot of trouble growing up, and maybe even later in life, right?
Yes, it did. I did have a violent temper. I had two speeds. It was either nice or mean. And I learned that I control that now, but it took a long time to control it, because you always had to be on the defensive when you're living the type of life I was living.
Right.
And we wouldn't take no shit from anybody, so automatically we had to set out to hurt them somewhere or another.
Right. How do you explain that temper? Is it, was it from the your background or the fact it had to be tough all the time? You know, because you're around tough guys all the time.
Well, my father had a vicious temper, and I seen him as a child growing up, this temper. And I think I picked up on a lot of it by that, and plus the people I grew up around, you know, everybody basically had a, a temper. We didn't take no shit from nobody.
Right. Well, obviously you're an intelligent guy, and I understand you have a really, really great memory. That's what I read on that sort of stuff. Did you have any aspirations to, you know, to go to school, or was that just something that never entered your mind, and you were just bent on being a gangster growing up?
No, I attempted school, but it could have been my fault, but I always had problems with the teachers. I was always getting, I would feel some of the times, bum raps, and I didn't want to be in school because I was getting punished for a lot, so I lost a lot of interest in the school, and I became violent in school with, like, the principal, let's say, you know.
Right. Did you get thrown out? You got thrown out of class and suspended?
I got thrown out of class a lot of times. One time a principal took me in the bathroom and he tried to beat me up, you know, nothing sexual, just beat me up because I was wearing my pants a little low. At that time, they wore their pants low.
Right. How old were you then?
Geez, I don't know. It was somewhere in, I think it was about eighth grade.
Wow.
Eighth grade.
But you survived that, and I guess you know, one of the major events growing up was meeting Tony Spilotro, right?
Well, Tony and I met. We shined shoes. We were shoe shine boys. He was on one side of the street and I was on the other. I didn't know that, and that's how we met. We met in the middle of the street, and he told me I was in his territory, and I told him I didn't see his name on the street sign, and one word led to another. And he said, if I'm here tomorrow, he was going to break my head. And the following day, I was there, and he didn't show up until a week later.
That's interesting. That sounds like Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano, how they met. You know, they had a confrontation when they were kids, and Meyer was a little pipsqueak, and Lucky appreciated his bravery in standing up, and they became friends. But he was called the Ant. Why was he called the Ant?
Well, nobody called him the Ant, really, except the news and the law. Tony got that name. It was sort of ridiculous. There was a wiretap on him, and he was talking to this guy, Mike. And Mike said, okay, Ant, you know, instead of saying Anthony, he called him Ant, meaning Anthony. And the feds had to wiretap this one federal guy. So they assumed that that was his nickname, which was not. That would be the last thing anybody would want to call him to his face.
Right. You know, he was a tough guy, right? What kind of guy was he? Did he have a violent temper like you, or was he?
No, he had a violent temper, too. And don't forget, we're short guys, so we always had to prove something, you know.
Right.
And so we had to fight, because it seemed like it was always a bigger guy that would try to pick on us. And, but Tony was very tough with his hands as a younger man, very tough.
Right, right on that. Did you have a nickname growing up?
Yeah, I did. They called me Brahma, like the Brahma Bull.
The Brahma Bull. Like the Brahma Bull in the China shop, right?
Not really. But you don't want to be around me when I got mad because I was like a brown smoke be coming out of my nose.
Well, I read your book, and I don't want to be around a swimming pool. We'll talk about that later, right? on that, but you know, you escalated. I mean, your life of you know, petty crimes, and describe how you eventually became a real life gangster.
Well, let me put it like this: everybody starts out as petty crime, you know, and
right.
Then you work up the ladder. You just don't fall into being a gangster.
Right.
I resisted being a gangster for many, many years. I always felt as though I didn't want to be told what to do, and I couldn't steal this and steal that. And I wanted to spend my money the way, you know, the way, if I made money legally, I wanted to spend it.
Mm-hmm.
But with them, you always had to keep a low profile. So I always was connected to the mob. Let me put it like this. I always was connected to the outfit. Always. And we refer to the syndicate or the mob as the outfit in Chicago.
Right.
And eventually, Tony, he moved to Vegas, and he needed me out there because he needed somebody to do the things he couldn't do out there because he was like, he couldn't go into the casinos and stuff. and he needed somebody to watch his back, and muscle bookmakers and so on.
Right. Well, before we go on to Las Vegas, and you went there in 1979, I believe, the outfit, it was the mob in Chicago, and how did they recruit you? And, does it have the same sort of rituals and everything that we hear about, La Cosa Nostra in New York?
No. You see, when you grew up in a neighborhood, as I said, with a bunch of outfit guys, mm-hmm. They see how you are and you're trustworthy. And how they really began to trust me is they needed to get a couple guys set up, or at least one of them, that committed a triple murder. That I almost was with to do this triple murder. I just happened to be busy that night. And Tony came and got me, and he wanted to know. They thought I was there, and I told him no. And after several hours of talking, he convinced me that if I didn't tell him the truth, that I would be whacked. So I gave up the guy that I knew was there and the other guy, and then I became involved. And that was probably in the 60s.
Right. Well, we had Henry Hill on the show, and he always said there was always an element of fear because you never knew when you might make a wrong mistake, with these really brutal characters that you're dealing with in the outfit. Did you feel that way, that you really had to watch your step be careful about what you said and what you did?
Well, you wouldn't have to, right? You wouldn't have to if you were doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you always gave them respect. Mm-hmm. If you didn't like what they said, you didn't react to it. You just took it and you figured, well, that's the law and that's the way it's got to be done. Excuse me. You followed their rules. Of course, you always had to worry about your best friend because he would usually be the one that gets you whacked.
Mm-hmm.
If you've done something wrong. So if you've done nothing wrong, you had nothing to worry about. No, I didn't have no level of fear. I may have felt uncomfortable at certain times when they were whacking guys, but then I thought, well, I had nothing to do with that. So I'm not.
You never had any close calls? Like where you?
Yeah, I did. I had a couple bum beefs. One time this outfit guy's son got beat up in my place.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lounge, and I had nothing to do with it. Truly had nothing to do with it, but his son said I did. And so it happened to be one of the guys in the place, I don't want to mention who it was, but he looked just like me, all right? And he was one of the characters involved, so this guy ran to get an okay to whack me in the head through Joey Iupa. And, of course, I called Tony in Vegas, and I told him what was going on. And then I had to meet our boss, who was Joe Lombardo. They call him Joey the Clown.
Right.
And I met him in Chicago about 2 days after that incident. And Joe told me that I was going to have to take a beating. I said, for what? He said, for this Louis DeMucci's son getting beat up. I said, Joe, it's bullshit. Because I had nothing to do with it. And he said, well, who did? I said, I can't tell you. Because the truth of the matter is, was my brother was there. All right, my brother sort of looks like me. Them guys are all dead and buried, so I'm not worried about that.
Right.
And so I had to take a beating from this guy. I let him hit me in the head with a brick 7 times. I had him break a bottle on my head. He still didn't do nothing to me, and Joe finally pulled me off of him. Could you imagine? I'm on top of him, letting him hit me on the head.
Wow.
And he's at the bottom. But I had to take this. So this guy couldn't go in and get an okay to get me whacked, because Joey Iupa was okay and everything.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. Did you, I guess you knew all the big shots with the outfit, Sam Giancana, Joe Batters, Acuerdo, Paul the Waiter, Ricci, for example. Who impressed you among those big shots in the outfit?
Paul the Waiter, Rico was a classy guy. He kept a low profile. He was the boss.
Mm-hmm.
In my time, he was definitely the top guy, but you never seen him around. You just noted the orders that he was the guy. Sam Giancana, I respected a lot because Sam was a man's man. In other words, he grew up like I did, on the streets and robbing cars and sticking up joints.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam and I became friends in the Cook County Jail in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
and then we met again when we were on the streets. Actually, I met him before I went to the Cook County Jail, and he told me, you got a rough temper. You got to control your temper. So I like Sam.
Right. Well, he had a temper too, right?
Yeah, he had a temper, but you know, you get older and you sort of tame out a little bit, and he was tame then, you know.
Right, and he was telling you from his experience, right?
Exactly.
Right. Did you listen?
Yeah, I did, because it don't pay to blow your stack. You have to take your time and study the situation or the conversation, because if you react too fast, you wind up getting yourself killed.
Right.
I got a quick question for Frank, if you don't mind. Just a quick one. The outfit in Chicago during your time, Frank, a lot of the guys, the names that are coming up and in all the stuff I've been researching are all Italian. Was there any Irish mobsters or Polacks, any other nationalities in the outfit that you know?
Well, I could tell you this much. There was a lot of Polacks. There was a lot of Irish ones. But they weren't, are you there? It sounds like we went up there. They were connected. They weren't involved. In other words, they knew a lot of mob guys, but they didn't work for the outfit. They were all thieves, mostly all thieves. And they were good thieves. Actually, the Polacks were probably the best thieves, you know. So, no, there was never big guy that I had to worry about that was an Irishman or a Polack.
In 1979, you, as you said earlier, you went out to Las Vegas. Did you want to leave Chicago? Was it a decision?
Well, I really never did want to leave Chicago. I had a successful nightclub, but I was getting harassed from the cops. It seemed like they just kept on pushing me to where I had to go steal, you know, again. They didn't want me to be legit, you know.
Right.
And I just did some time and I just did 6 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then they were killing all these guys in Chicago. I mean, they killed like 10 guys. So I didn't know what was coming next, you know. So then just happened to be timing. Tony called and said he needed me real bad.
Right.
And he didn't want, you know, he just wanted me. And I had to bring a crew.
A crew? What do you mean? What do you mean by crew?
Guys, I had to bring my own army out there. He didn't want
an army of how many men?
Well, I brought four guys with me, and we used to send for others. You know, I used to send for others if needed. So we had a bunch of Chicago, like six guys in and out all the time. You know, but four.
Are they still
all
alive, there. Frank? Are they still alive? These guys?
You know, I think they're all dead, to be truthful, which I don't, except for one guy, Leo Gardino. Mm-hmm. I don't know what became of him or Wayne Metecky. I know Larry Newman, the guy we refer to as Lurch in my book, you read that.
Yeah.
He died in a state prison. He was a diehard Jew, which I never realized that he was so much into that faith until he requested, what do you call them, yarmulkes, them things they put on their heads?
Right.
Wanted to be buried with one of them on his head, so I was like a little shocked.
Yeah, I like that Lurch. That's one of the all-time great mob nicknames.
Oh, he was the crazy bastard. This guy was a real sick man.
Well, but did you like Las Vegas?
I love Las Vegas. Las Vegas, you got to adapt to it. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's certain times of the day you just don't walk outside because it's too hot.
Right.
So you go from an air conditioning car to an air conditioned lounge or casino. You'd mostly come out at night, you know. It was even hard swimming in the day because it's so damn hot, you know.
Right.
So you had to adjust your whole lifestyle around the weather conditions there.
Right.
But no, I liked it. There was a lot of, I had a lot of fun out there.
Right. And then Nicholas,
made a lot of money, too.
Nicholas Pelagi wrote your introduction. He's one of my favorite writers, really a great writer. And he called Las Vegas a felony paradise.
Well, that's what you found out when you moved to
Las Vegas? Was it a felony paradise?
You got to remember something. When I moved there, it was they didn't want no guys like us robbing houses because they wanted to keep the heat down. But when I moved there, I got that okay that we could do that, our houses or businesses, so my men could earn money, you know, the guys that worked for us.
Right.
So yes, it was a paradise for robbery then. I mean, there was a lot of money there.
Before we get into your years in Las Vegas, let's take a station break, Willie, and we'll get back with our fascinating guest, Frank Collada.
You bet. What an intriguing story Frank has to tell. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Our fascinating guest this evening is the one and only Frank Collada. Now back to Ron and Mr. Collada.
Thank you. And we're back with Frank Collada. He was the co-author of Collada, The Life of Chicago Criminal, Las Vegas Mobster, and Government Witness. Frank has a website, and I'll spell his name for you. You should go there, check his book out. I think you could order the book from there, right, Frank?
Yeah, you could order the book through Amazon.com, right. Or you could go to Huntington Press in Las Vegas and get it. I don't know what the price is on it. We got a webpage going up. It's not quite completed yet.
Right.
And there's going to be a lot of things you'll be able to order off that webpage. I'll let you know when that's...
Okay, then, sure. Drop us a note, and we'll mention it on the show. But meantime, go to Frank's website, Collada, Collotta.com.
And also on Facebook.
Well, you're on Facebook. I'm a friend of yours on Facebook, so you can join Frank there. Do you have a Twitter account?
I do, but I don't know how to work the damn thing yet. Listen, I just got used to Facebook.
Right. Well, I mean, you spend all your life with all this social messaging, right, with Twitter, Facebook, website. It's a lot different than Las Vegas in the 80s, right?
Well, you know, my expertise were how to shut alarms off and open up safes.
Yeah.
Now I'm in a new era, you know. It's all about the computer.
Right. Well, you know, you did everything. You extorted legal bookmakers, when I read drug dealers throughout Las Vegas. You ran that, quote, murder and robbery crew. How'd you have time to do all that? I mean, were you a workaholic, so to speak?
Well, you know, I added these group of guys, as I told you. At first, I used to go out and do a lot of that stuff myself.
Uh-huh.
But then when I had the crew out there, of course, I just sat back, and they would bring the merchandise. I call it merch. It's stolen stuff. And we'd check it, and then I'd dump it. I'd sell it. You know, I'd have the outs. Of course, I had the tipsters, too. They used to give us the tips, and I used to give them to my guys, my crew.
Right.
So I really, near the end there, I really didn't... do hardly any of that anymore.
Right.
You know, do all the rum.
What'd you do with your money? You're making a pile of...
You got to remember something. There's 24 hours in the day I didn't work. So I had 24 hours a day to spend my money.
What kind of money were you spending?
Oh, my God. I gambled thousands. I used to gamble thousands in the casino, spend thousands on girls and liquor and food. Of course, I used to get a lot of free stuff, too, in the casinos, and I get a lot of comps.
Right. Well, I mean, were you like a celebrity? People must have knew who you were. You were Tony Spilatro's right-hand man. Did you get special treatment? And
all the
did you
time.
Feel important walking around Las Vegas?
Well, let me put it like this. I got married in the Stardust, and they got a gourmet room in there. They call it the Moby Dick.
Uh-huh.
I had no idea that my wedding, was going to be comped. I went in there to figure to spend some money in the Stardust, and at the end of the night, when I asked for the check, they said it's on the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I had like 50 people there, so, you know, and they were all drinking champagne and wine, so, you know, that bill was out.
Right. Well, we had a couple ex-gangsters on our show, and they said that, you know, women are attracted to mobsters. Did you find that to be true? That women
look
like you were a rock star?
Women and movie stars. Women and movie stars. They love you. They want to be by you. Well, you know, it's protection. They figure you're muscle, you're strong, you got influence, there's things you could reach. You know.
Right.
Remember, you know, like in Illinois, if I kick back, you know, that's a pretty corrupt city over there as far as politics go. Vegas wasn't like that when I was there.
Well, who are some of the famous people that like to rub shoulders with you?
Like movie stars?
Yeah, like movie stars, women, were there, you know, like any women that were prominent actresses and stuff like that?
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you the truth, I don't remember their names. There were some beautiful women, and I don't remember their names. I know Wayne Moon used to come in my joint a lot, and Burke Young, and what was this other guy? Oh, Robert Conrad.
Oh, Robert Conrad, right.
Yeah, Minnelli, what's this guy, Minnelli? He played in the Bye Bye Black Sheep.
Right.
There was a bunch of them. You know, actually, I can't even remember half of them, but there was a whole bunch of them that used to come along there.
And according to what I read, you still had time to be a hitman. Is that an accurate description of what you did when you had to deal with people that...
Well, that was in my profession. Let me put it like that. Mm-hmm. If I was ordered to do something like that, of course I would have to do it, because if I didn't do it, then I would be killed from the people that ordered me to do it, because then I would... The reason why that being is because I would be in the know, you know, and if they didn't want to keep any witnesses around.
Mm-hmm.
So if it came to me to do something, of course I would have to do it.
How many people did you whack?
Well, let's say two indirectly and two directly.
I read that somewhere. You said that. That must be your answer. What does that mean, directly, two indirectly and two directly? Conjures up all kinds of images in my mind.
Well, it does. Well, one indirectly was when I... had a set of Billy McCarthy. That was the M&M killer.
Oh, yeah, the M&M. 62, kind of. And when was that? That was 62.
Somewhere around in the 60s. Yeah. Some years all run together. They were so active for me.
Right.
And so that's an indirect. And then this other guy, Bob Brown, I sent Larry Newman and Wayne Metecky to rob him in Illinois, and they were only supposed to rob him, but Larry Newman decided that he wanted to kill the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Which
yeah, Frank, you were quoted as saying, I read, you said you became the judge, jury, and executioner. So you justify that in your own mind, so it makes it a little easier on you. Most of the guys you whacked, who got whacked or killed, I'd say the majority of them probably deserved it. Do you still believe that?
Well, no, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. Look, I'm not supposed to be an executioner, you know what I mean? Come
right,
on.
Right.
You know, at the time, it was something that I was required to do, and I justified it that way. Did I dislike any of the people? Only one guy, and it was the guy that I directly killed, but I wouldn't have done that unless I was ordered to do it. He was a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a bad guy.
I told you I didn't want to be around a swimming pool with you. That was the jury listener,
yeah,
which is a really chilling part of your book. It was, you know, Dennis Griffith wrote it so matter-of-factly, but this guy was hard to kill, right? I mean, it was just amazing.
I shot him in the head, I think, about 12 times.
Right, and he still lived, and you couldn't reach for a knife, was it? I think it was.
Well, it was by the water cooler, so right. I couldn't reach the knife, so I grabbed it. Cable and a cord, and I wrapped it around his neck, and it broke.
Right.
So then my partner, who was outside, came in because he heard all the shooting. And what possessed him to bring in more bullets is beyond me. I have no idea. And he came in with more bullets, and I loaded the gun and put the rest in him. And, you know, being that I had no gloves on, DNA, you know, even then we're aware of that stuff. I said, let's throw him in the pool. Wash up in the water a little bit over there. So we did.
Yeah, well, you talk very freely in the book, you know, writes very freely about some of these incidents. Are you still, you're obviously not legally liable. Is this part of the deal you made with the government?
Yeah, I got immunity from prosecution as long as I told the truth. On any trials and stuff, I could never be charged for any of these crimes that I committed.
Right.
So it was great. I forgot the name of the immunity, but it was good immunity.
Right.
Not that I could like to run around and brag about that shit, you know.
Right, that's right.
But
it's part of your life. Part of your life.
I testified on it in court, so I'm not saying something I didn't say in court, you know.
Right, right. But, you know, you had your detractors, like former Mayor Oscar Goodman. I think he was former legal counsel for Spilotro. He said you were a notorious liar.
Well, of course he's going to say that. Oscar was my co-attorney on a case, you know.
Right.
Of course, Oscar and I, we still feud, you know. But
right.
Here, look at this. Can I say this real quick? We Oscar opened up the Mob Museum in Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And who do you think is all over the wall in there? Me. He's got to get along with me because I'm a part of history,
that's
you know.
Right. Yeah.
He'd rather see me underneath the museum People, you got to go see this Mad Museum.
We're going to come out there. It just opened up, right?
Yeah, it's great. I opened it. You know, we had a big opening party, VIP party. It's got everything in there. I mean, every kind of law enforcement deal and criminal deal. Mobsters that you didn't even know exist are on that wall in there. Right. You know, it's really interesting.
Right. Well, you had more than your 15 minutes of fame because you were portrayed twice on the screen, right? By John Santucci in Michael Mann's TV show Crime Story.
Could you imagine that John Santucci took my part?
Okay.
And that was Thief. That was The Thief, the movie The Thief.
Right, The Thief. And then Martin Scorsese's classic, right? Casino. Right.
Casino, yeah. Right. I played a big part in that movie.
Right. They actually recreated a murder that you committed?
That was Jerry Lisner.
Right, the Jerry Lisner murder.
Yeah.
And did you get a chance to meet Scorsese?
I was with him every day. I used to sit right next to him on the set, right in the one of them director chairs. And I used to tell him, nope, that's not good, that's wrong. And he'd correct that, you know, like
right.
The language. He had New York guys that speak a little different than us, and they would use different terms,
right.
Like instead of saying merch, which is stolen stuff, he'd call it merch, they were saying swag. Well, we don't use that word in Chicago, swag. Or we don't say jerk off, we say jag off, you know. So I had to change all that stuff, you know. Well, I mean, it's a little bit of stuff, but a lot like how they dressed and stuff, you know.
Right. Yeah. Did you think Casino did justice to, you know, the gangster life?
It did good. It did good. It could have done a little bit better, but they can only go so far to get by the editors, you know, and all of that stuff.
Right. Right.
But, no, he did a good job. Marty did a good job. You know, I think he did a good job.
Right. Do you still stay in touch with him, or is that part of
it? These guys, they make you. They get you up there. They get everything out of you, and then I never hear from him again. Except from Nick Pelleggi. I hear from Nick Pelleggi only when I call him. But.
Right. Yeah, he seems like, I've heard him speak. He's one of my favorite writers, like I said. And
He's well-versed.
Right, and
During the movie, Frank, did you cross paths with De Niro at all?
All the time. And Bob, when I call him Bob, it sounds like, how could you call him Bob? But I got along with Bob real good. I mean, I've had meetings with him before we've done the movie at certain locations, you know, so I got to meet him on a personal level. And I met Joe Pesci before the movie, and I met Sharon Stone. I met them all in the Wilshire Hotel down in Beverly Hills. The last meeting, and then they approved everything, and De Niro got the final okay to that. He wanted me in the movie, and that's when. But I met De Niro about three times before we did the movie, but seen him every day and talked to him.
Willie, let's take another station break, and we'll go into the last session. We will have about 10 minutes, and we'll finish up with the other part of the story.
You bet, Ronnie. What a fascinating guest. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Harib. Our fascinating guest this evening is the one and only Frank Kalata. Now back to Frank, Ron and Frank.
Right. If you just tuned in, we're with Frank Kalata, and he's the co-author of his biography, Kalata, The Life of the Chicago Criminal, Las Vegas Mobster, and Government Witness. And the book can be bought at Amazon.com and Huntington Press. Go to his website. Kalata.com, CULLOTTA.com for more information. You'll have a website going up, and we'll have more information on that on a future show. Follow him on Facebook, and you can see from our interview that this is a hell of a book, and we highly recommend that you go out and get a copy to get the full story. We're just touching parts of it. And everything changed. You had a falling out with Spilotro, right? Your buddy.
Yeah, Tony had a lot of pressure on him. And he had originally told me that he had the okay to whack a listener
right.
from Chicago. Because
right.
that stuff had to be, you had to get okay from the upper guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I took him for his word on it. I did challenge him on it one time. And he said, don't you believe me? And I said, well, yeah, I believe you, you know. I said, but I don't want no repercussions, you know, over this shit. And then I've come to find out that he lied about that because on one of my meetings back in Chicago, I went back to drop some money off for to the outfit, and one of the head guys said to me, what the fuck is going on back there? Who's killing all them people? He wouldn't ask me a stupid question like that, right?
Right.
If he knew.
Right.
So right then and there, I knew Tony didn't get the okay. And then he also asked me, he says, is Tony screwing the Jews' old lady, meaning Lefty Rosenthal? You know, that's the guy who ran the Starbucks.
And he was, right?
Yes, he was. And I knew that for a fact. And when I came back, I told Tony the questions that were asked to me. And he said, what did you say? I said, well, yeah, I told him you were screwing the Jews' old lady. I said, of course I didn't tell him. I said, but I know one thing. I signed my death certificate along with yours if they were fine on different.
Wow.
And then Tony was getting goofy. You know, he was getting goofy. He was saying that I was a wild man out there. He couldn't control me. That's nonsense. You know what I mean? I was only following orders. I was just one of them guys. I was a good, let's say, a good employee, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And he let me down. He let me down. He was throwing me to the wolves.
Right. But he got his in the end, right? The famous scene in Casino where, you know, body was dumped.
That was
based on his murder, right?
Yeah, see, you know, there's a discrepancy over that. And I tell everybody, when Tony got killed, I don't believe, and it had a lot to do with his brother. I'd say so. His brother was the main problem in the whole deal, his kid brother Michael, who was causing a lot of problems back there. He was leaning on his brother's reputation, and he wasn't liked by the head guy at the time back there. So Tony was of no more value because he just was screwing up so bad out there. And they knew if they killed Michael, they'd have to kill Tony. So they whistled Tony back, and Tony was going back, I believe in my heart, to defend his brother's actions. And he walked into a trap, and and that's what happened. So any stories you hear other than that, I don't believe. I believe what I'm telling you is about as close to the truth as it's going to be.
But essentially, you became a government informant for your own survival, right? Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
You had no place to turn, and it was either becoming a witness or death.
Well, let me put it like this, yeah. Not many people will have 36 associates or friends in their lifetime. I've seen 36 of my friends that I either stole it or were good friends of mine all get whacked by the outfit.
Wow.
Now, I think that I made a reasonable decision. I would rather them say, call me a jerk, rat, whatever they want to call me, than say, well, I'm in the grave. Boy, what a stand-up guy. Big freaking deal. You know what I mean? So, I seen too many guys murder their best friends. So I'm just a little smarter.
It's kind of hard to say, to answer, thank you, lying in a grave, right?
Yeah, I mean, who knows if they said, what a stand-up guy. You know, that's bullshit. You know what I mean?
Well, so you became a government witness. How many gangsters did you put away? From your testimony?
I never really kept count of them.
But there were a lot, right?
Yeah, I testified in front of the, Oregon, Washington, D.C., Crime Commission, New York Crime Commission, Florida. I put away a lot of guys, Joe Lombardo one time with that Roy Williams, and the pension fund, all that stuff there. I was part of that team there. And, one guy, I got life in prison, and stuff like that. I hate to think about all them guys, but they're all gone.
Right. We've had other guests on, and, they ended up in the witness protection, and most of them, in fact, I think all of them, did not like the witness protection program. They said it sucked. What were your feelings about it?
One thing about the witness protection program, they put you in there, and they tell you, the things you should do and the things you shouldn't do. If you follow what they tell you to do, you'll never get killed. If you don't listen to what they say, you're going to get yourself killed. All right? They get you, they don't do it, they get you a birth certificate and a social security number. And they don't get you a job. You have to find your own job. If you need schooling to get a job, they will pay for that. They will pay for your furniture, they will pay for a jalopy car. So they do as much as they can. Of course you don't like it. Mm-hmm. It's not the lifestyle you're used to living. Mm-hmm. But they do their job. I have to say they did their job, you know. And but I stood in there 2 years and said, I, you know.
How many years were you in? How many years were you in?
In the witness protection? Mm-hmm. 2 years. 2 years in. That's all. Two years in jail and 2 years in the program, the street program. They got two of them, you know.
Right. Did you get out? Did you leave the program because you wanted to leave the program?
Yeah, I wrote him a letter, and I said, by the time you get this letter to the inspector, they got inspectors, mm-hmm. I watch it. I said, I'll be long gone. I said, but I just can't make it no more in here. So I just left. I got my stuff, and I left out.
Wow. But there was a contract on your life, right? I understand.
Well, yes, there was. There was a big contract on my life. But again, I didn't go to Chicago. I mean, I snuck in and out. Nobody ever knew when I was sneaking in and out to see family and stuff like that. I didn't stand in a corner. Mm-hmm. I didn't go to events and have speaking engagements, nor did I write a book. Or I didn't do anything for 25 years. Mm-hmm. I laid down because I know how long, you know, I mean, until everybody was in jail. Now they're all in jail and dead. So I can do what I want to do now.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to look over your shoulder, right?
Well, I still do because it's a habit. You never forget these things. You know, it's just I look over my shoulder for the cops even to this day. Yeah. And I don't do nothing wrong, but I still look over my shoulder. You know, you never know.
Well, yeah, I'm amazed at how easy it is to get in touch with you. You know, given your life, and we have a mutual friend, Tony. You know, and yeah, I could call him, and he's got your number. And I'm sure other people. I know Henry Hills got your number. I mean, it's just amazing that you could live like that, you know, given your life. And
now it's over 30 years now. Right. You know, it's over 30 years. I'm like a prehistoric person over here. Right. You know, I'm the oldest guy of all these guys that rolled. You know, and they're all like I said. I go to Vegas all the time. I mean, I'm in and out of Vegas like nothing. You know, I don't live there. You think I live there, but I don't. I'm in and out of there.
Right.
You know, and I stay at hotels, and when I walk in and out of them, everybody seems to know me in these damn places. They never forget you.
Is life exciting?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was in the Stratosphere the last time, and I'm walking up to the check-in, and the guy's looking at me. He says, "You can't be." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "You're Frank Collada." And I said, "Oh, fuck." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Man," he says, "what a pleasure to meet you." You know, like I'm saying, you'd be surprised how many people really look up to you. And I give them a book. I got the book. I wanted to silence them. I bought them for a book.
Is the mob still big as they were back in your day in Las Vegas?
No. I doubt if there's any mob there at all. From what
no mob at all?
I doubt it very seriously.
Wow.
It's all corporate. The town's full of corporate people. Right. Big corporations got it. You know what I mean? They're scared to death of being involved with organized crime. They don't want to lose their gaming license, you know, shit like that.
Right.
So, no.
Right. Well, I mean, what do you think of the mob today? Does it have a future? You know, you have all these godfathers, you know, turning against their crew, and they look to be in disarray. And there's so many other ethnic groups now that have sprung up that are powerful. Do you think?
I think as far as Chicago is concerned, I can't speak for New York or Jersey or Philly or wherever, but I would believe in my heart that Chicago it's done. They may have a few alpha guys running around there, but anybody that sits in the throne usually goes to jail.
Right.
I don't think that's anymore over there. Right.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up our interview. My last question is, when you look back on your incredible life, do you have any regrets? Is there anything that you would have done differently?
You know, I can't say I do, because I am what I am today because of what I was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a better man today. Not that I'm telling people that they should do what I've done, but I did learn from my mistakes, and I am a better person today.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, Willie and I both like to go to Las Vegas, so maybe we could look you up and have a beer with you sometime.
Not a problem. I don't drink, but not a problem. I'll have a Coke.
Well, we'll have a Coke then.
Okay.
Yeah. On that then. Frank Collada, thank you so much for being on our show. This has been a real treat.
My pleasure, gentlemen. My pleasure.
Okay, and we hope to talk to you again. Thank you.
Anytime, anytime.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, Willie.
Well, thanks, Ronnie, and thank you again to our very special guest, Frank Culotta. It was a fascinating interview, and we were delighted to have him on our program. What a great guest. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about the interview tonight?
Man, I learned Frank Culotta had a remarkable career as a gangster, and even more remarkable is the fact that somehow he lived to talk about it and to appear on our Crime Beat show. My hat's off to him for that achievement. How about you, Willie?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I learned you don't mess around with Frank Culotta, especially when he was in Vegas or in Chicago. He was a quintessential gangster, man, who led a violent and criminal life. But I guess he saw the light, had an epiphany of sorts, and turned his life around, became a government informant, and managed to stay alive. You know what? He had no choice,
right,
or he'd be swimming with the fishes, man.
Right.
Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat history segment, Lesson of the Month. Who was that gangster? Hey, Ronnie, this one is on that famous mobster, Mayor Lansky. Mayor Lansky, the son of Jewish parents, was born in Grodno, Russia on the 4th of July, 1902. In 1911, his family settled in New York City. Lansky met Bugsy Siegel and Lucky Luciano. The three young hoods became involved in crime, and by the 1920s, Lansky had his own gang. Lansky, after establishing gambling operations in Florida, New Orleans, and Cuba, as a major investor in the Flamingo Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, he was alleged to have arranged Bugsy Siegel's execution in 1947, when he became convinced that Bugsy was fiddling the books. By the 1960s, Lansky was involved in drug smuggling, pornography, prostitution, and extortion. It was estimated at the time that his total holdings were worth $300 million. In 1970, Lansky heard that the U.S. government wanted him for income tax evasion, and he fled to Israel, where he was arrested and returned to the United States. He died in Miami Beach in 1983. He was estimated that when he died, he was worth over $400 million. Hey, Ronnie, that's a lot of dough. Any comments?
It certainly is, and I don't think any person played a bigger role in the development of Miami. And Meyer Lansky's story is going to be on the Magic City, which is going to be on Stars in April, and I was interviewed for the documentary that's going with that eight-part series, so the listeners can tune into that show to find more about Meyer Lansky.
Yeah, what a famous guy. Now, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for March the 8th. Our guest will be Stacey Didrick in a command performance. Stacey Didrick is an award-winning author and decorated 17-year police officer veteran and former detective who specialized in sex crimes. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we would like to thank all of you for listening to our broadcast this evening. Now, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsick and myself, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.